The title that Harold just mentioned is due to the fact that Akato and Richard asked me for a title before I had a paper, and so I gave them one. Now I have a paper, and it's titled, the actual title of the paper is Moses and Mono-Wittgensteinism. It's the title of the paper. Actually, it's not a very good title for the talk, because I've had to cut it down so much that this title doesn't fit that way well. As you'll see, I think a better title for the talk would be Martin and Mono-Wittgensteinism, for reasons that will become clear. And I'll be saying a bit about this movement that Harold so affectionately mentioned, which that has to do with an interpretive framework for understanding the Tractatus, sometimes called now the resolute reading of the Tractatus. And I thought I'd like to just begin by noting a common criticism of that reading. The problem with the reading, with our reading, so it's alleged, is that it commits one to the view that there is only one Wittgenstein. And in fact, I was just reading today in the bathroom a few minutes ago this wonderful book, Wittgenstein, the Philosopher and His Works, which Alois and Seymour are trying to sell you copies of. And I thought it'd help them out. David Stern's article is about the following issue, which he thinks is unfortunate. It's nearly always presupposed, David Stern says on page 170, that either there was only one Wittgenstein, that in essentials, Wittgenstein's philosophy never really changed, or that there were two Wittgensteins, that there was a fundamental change between the early and the late philosophy. Now, I know lots of people who think the second thing. Many books are built on the premise that, are organized around the premise, that's right. But you might wonder who thinks the first thing. Well, the people who think the first thing, David Stern will tell you, are Cora Diamond and James Conant. And the general suggestion is, if you accept their way of reading the Tractatus, then you are committed to that. You are committed to that view. Those are the two alternatives. He thinks that's unfortunate. But he also thinks that, if so, facto means you can't accept their reading of the Tractatus. So it turns out I'm talking about David Stern today, among others. So that's just a quick way of saying that it's come to pass that we, call us resolute readers of the Tractatus, are taken to espouse the heresy of what you might call mono-Wittgensteinism. If you wanted to lend an Islamic flavor to the creed here issue, I suppose you might be able to sum it up like this. There's no Wittgenstein but Wittgenstein, and his name is Wittgenstein. Now, whatever your attitude towards the corresponding tenet of Islam, I think you can be forgiven for wondering why that sentence I just uttered ought not to be interpreted as expressing a fairly uncontroversial thought about Wittgenstein. What's the alternative to affirming that thought? What is poly-Wittgensteinism? Well, I suppose it's the view that there were at least two Wittgensteins, the most famous two of them bearing the names early Wittgenstein and later Wittgenstein. But of course, no one believes that those two individuals bear the sort of relation to each other that, say, Irving Berlin and Isaiah Berlin bear to each other. Early and later are not, in that sense, first names. So what is it in this squabble that one side believes that the other side wants to deny? When the charge is leveled at resolute readers by their critics, that they hold this mistaken view that there's only one Wittgenstein, whereas every educated person, of course, should know there's at least two. Evidently, it cannot be some banal form of mono-Wittgensteinism that such readers as myself are taken to espouse by my critics. This should be some genuinely heretical one. Well, what is it? I think one significant clue as to what this heretical sect of mono-Wittgensteinians must believe can be found, a clue can be found to what they must believe by looking at refutations of them. So what suffices to refute such a view? And there's a number of things here, but I want to respond to one form of refutation in this paper. And it's a kind of refutation that proceeds on the basis of what's called external evidence. External evidence of two sorts comes in question here. One drawn from the early work, one drawn from the later work. I have a separate paper on the first topic. My topic is the second topic today, that is external evidence drawn from the later work. I think you can partly see what mono-Wittgensteinians must believe, why they believe there have been no essential changes, by how these refutations proceed. The evidential value of each item in this sort of collection of evidence is thought to lie in the fact that it shows later at Wittgenstein to be concerned to put forward criticisms of his early self and what seems to qualify each item in the collection as evidence in the relevant sense often tends to be not much more than that it contains expressions such as, I used to think, contrary to my earlier view, whereas the author of the Tractatus Logico Philosophicus held, blah, 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 I now, blah, blah, blah. And these things are reduced, sometimes in really large collections, just, you know, to really crush the opponent, as refutations. Now, the question is, ought a resolute reader to be discomforted by the fact that Lincoln collects such things? There's a lot to say about this, but I want to just bring out one kind of point about it in this paper today. And the point of doing it isn't just defensiveness, but to try to say something about how we should understand the relationship between early and later Wittgenstein. And in particular, if we are interested in later Wittgenstein's criticisms of early Wittgenstein, how should we find them in looking at the later work? And what is it we're looking for? And what sort of thought does it take to weigh them as such? I said I am a representative of this reading of the Tractatus, sometimes called Resolute. I don't really have time to say very much about what that is. I'm sort of hoping, given who you are, I know many of you are already familiar with this. I'll just mention, because it'll be relevant, some very brief features of what you believe if you believe in such a reading. One thing you're going to reject, I'm going to mention things you reject if you're a holder of Resolute. And that already brings out the fact that what this framework for reading the Tractatus is a framework. That is, it leaves undetermined a great many things you could think. It's pointing out some things you better not think. One thing you could reject, you want to reject, is that what the author of the work calls upon his reader to do in a section like 6.54 at the end of the book, that what he's asking the reader to do is something like apply to the sentences of the work a theory of meaning that's advanced in the work. So you got a theory about what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. We apply it to the sentence of the book and we realize, oh, gee, lots of them are nonsense. Something like that is a framework for understanding why he's saying what he's saying in 6.54. That is, the theory that you're given in the book is taken to specify the conditions under which sentences make sense and the conditions under which they don't. Resolute readers, on the other hand, reject the idea that the author of the work aims to put forward any theory or doctrine. And again, notice, that is merely something about how the book ought not to be read. Further, I think resolute readers are going to take an appreciation of this avowedly anti-theoretical character of the early work to have far-reaching exegetical consequences. I don't really think it's an exaggeration to say that everything else they hold about the book flows from that commitment. It would be much too much work to spell all of those consequences out here, but let's just mention a couple. One is that they're going to reject the idea that there's any intended commitment to, say, an ineffable theory or doctrine. That's not going to really be a way of taking the point. A second, equally crucial, and to many of you familiar corollary of this reading, is going to lie in a rejection of the idea that the Tractatus holds that there's anything like logically distinct kinds of nonsense. And maybe it's further worth mentioning. The point is not to quarrel with one theory of nonsense to introduce another. From the vantage of a resolute reader, it doesn't really make much difference whether the account given is one that rests on verifiability or an appeal to bipolarity or features of logical syntax or some other putative respect in which philosophical propositions are identified as nonsensical because of their being combined in some logically illegitimate or flawed or conceptually untoward manner. All such accounts, all such readings of the book are going to equally qualify as instances of an irresolute reader if they're committed to ascribing to the book a theory which its author must endorse and rely upon if he's able to prosecute his program of philosophical critique, and which he must also regard as nonsense if he thinks through the commitments of his own theory. It's in this sense that resolute readers think that standard readers need to be able to eat their cake while holding on to it. They need to be able to reject the sentences of the book as nonsense while being able to continue to identify, grasp, and believe what those sentences would be saying if they had a sense, such that it leads to those commitments. That's the sense in which standard readings are going to look to be comparatively irresolute in the lights of such a reader. So to be resolute here means to take the sort of recognition that the reader of the work is called upon to attain in recognizing the sentences of the work that elucidate through the recognition that they're nonsensical to involve a recognition that in an earlier stage of reading the book, an intermediate stage, in which as readers of the work, we continue to take ourselves to be able to identify, grasp, and believe what those sentences say or are not quite able to say, that stage, that intermediate stage, is itself part of the illusion that the work as a whole seeks to explore. It is one of the rungs on the ladder that we're asked to climb up and then throw away. Rungs on the ladder. Now, I couldn't possibly, even if I just spent the whole hour doing this, list all the things that you might count as rungs on the ladder. But I'd like to just give you an indication of this. So the first page of the handout is serving that purpose. These are examples of some rungs on the ladder. I'll use the first list here not just to be identical with what I've listed here, but by the notion of first list I'm going to use here has to do with anything which belongs on that list, of which I've provided the beginnings of an indication of. So this is what I'm calling the first list. Anything that belongs on this list and the numbered propositions that are actually on your handout represent theses or apparent theses that are floated in the book. And for the most part, theses that commentators have wanted to ascribe to the author of that work. According to resolute readers, to ascribe such theses to the author of the work is to fail to understand him. It's to fail to understand that it's part of the aim of this book to get us to see that, transcendentally speaking, there's nothing to say, that we are left with silence. Now, there's much about this list that's arbitrary. The very idea of trying to draw up such a list involves various problems. Maybe it's just worth mentioning a few. The beginning of the list is quite arbitrary. I could have started further back at even more basic commitments. I just wouldn't have gotten very far. I wanted to kind of sketch at least something like a framework of the book as it appears on certain standard readings. Also, more importantly, in many points, actually, an item in the list could be replaced with something that has the form of its logical opposite. So if you look at item 2 in your handout, on page 2 of your handout, I've given you variants on proposition 3. 3A. 3A, in turn, could be modified into something that has a more palpably idealist-sounding edge. Or if you prefer, you can modify it to 3C, that has a more solipsistic sounding variant. This is realism, idealism, solipsism. Rungs of the ladder can be modified into these forms. They might appear to be opposite, but are equally rungs in the sense that I'm understanding how this works. And it's worth mentioning here again that in the commentary on the Tractatus, there are interpretations that advocate each of three rather than, say, 3A. Rather than, say, 3B or 3C, arguing in favor of the one as the central doctrine of the work, and thinking this can be shown by the way in which the work argues against the others. Thus, much of the secondary literature in the book assumes the form of the debate between those who hold that the direction of explanation should flow somehow from the nature of reality to the nature of language, and those who think, no, that order of explanation should be reversed. And I think there are also interpretations, frankly, that just sort of hover unstably between them. If you're a resolute reader and holding these to be rungs, you're going to hold that each of the philosophical positions that results from privileging either of these directions of explanation figures equally, and in a sense, together, jointly, as rungs on the ladder that we're invited to climb. It's a mistake in trying to understand the aim of the work as a whole to try to figure out which of these options we're supposed to settle on. For what the work aims to show is that the sense of candidate runs like 3A, 3B, 3C depend on each other, and that they stand or fall together. That, if you will, strictly thought through realism and idealism, realism and solipsism collapse into one another. That is part of what the work is trying to show. At many points, the above list could be continued also in another way, in what you might think of as either of two opposite directions, because even these items on the list could further be impacted in either of two ways to suggest opposed philosophical doctrines. And here I'm concerned with another kind of debate that is much in the secondary literature in which people think you're supposed to choose sides. We might call it a debate between atomists and holists. So take proposition 2, for instance. that could be written out a little more so that either of the following two questions might seem like a candidate thesis to attribute to the Tractatus, either 2a or 2b, where the truth of each is understood to depend on the falsity of the other. And here, too, much of the secondary literature in the book has assumed the form of a debate between those who hold the direction of explanation should flow from the nature of the fundamental elements of the proposition, names, relations, and so forth, and the process of meaning upon, a process by which meaning is first conferred upon names, then they enter into these propositions, flow from such elements to the nature of the proposition as a whole, now understood as a combination of those antecedently available elements. One side of the debate. Another side of the debate. Those who think, no, that order of explanation should be reversed. You can't understand an element in the proposition without understanding its role in the proposition. And there's a parallel debate. You might think this is a different, important issue, not about language, but about ontology. The point here is to see the structure is parallel. A debate, say, about the nature of simple objects and states of affairs. Do the objects first exist and enter into certain combinations? Or are they what they are only in virtue of their antecedently fixed possibilities of combination? Here, too, resolute readers are going to hold that each of the philosophical positions that results from privileging either of these directions of explanation figure equally as rungs in the ladder or invited to climb. To save space, what I've done starting with item 5 on this list is I've introduced parentheses as a way of sort of quickly indicating some of the possible variants on the rungs. But what all items on this list have in common, that's what marks these things out as forms of words that belong in what I'm calling the first list, is that they express a metaphysical commitment that figures in the Tractatus as a philosophical temptation that the author intends the reader to overcome, and indeed is struggling to help the reader to overcome. Such sentences are ones to which a reader can be drawn, that the work is positioned in a way to draw the reader to, and which will figure initially as ones that the reader takes to express a thought she's able to understand, and perhaps at a later stage in her ascent, take herself to be able to discern that it's in some way attempting and failing to express a thought, and yet believes she knows what insight it is that this failed attempt at the expression of thought seeks to convey. And a resolute reading is going to hold that we come to understand the author of the work when we come to recognize that all of these first list, shall we call them, putative forms of understanding and discernment involve illusions of understanding and discernment. So that's all I'm going to say about the resolute reading by way of exposition. That already took too long. Sorry. Now, faced with this first page of the handout, that is, with this list of apparent theses, along with the news that resolute readers think that the author of the Tractatus is, say, as concerned as the author of the investigation to help us overcome our attraction to sentences such as these. Standard readings, readers, more traditional readers, tend to be left with some version of the following question and reaction. But then, and this is what I take it's going on David Stern, what's left of the difference between early and later Wittgenstein? If we take these things to be objectionally metaphysical already by early Wittgenstein's life, then isn't it true that there's nothing left for later Wittgenstein to criticize in his early work? There's nothing left that could count as objectionably metaphysical by his later lights. Is that true? Part of what I want to bring out is how that very assumption not only blinkers our reading of the Tractatus, but tremendously blinkers our reading of the investigations and where the real work is being done in the later philosophy. But let me first plead guilty to a form of mono-Wittgensteinism. That is, I do think it's not just a misperception. There is something quite right about the thought that if you accept the resolute reading, that is going to place you in a position to be struck by forms of continuity between the early philosophy and the later philosophy that you might not have noticed. I'm going to indicate these at breathtaking speed so I can get on to other things. So I apologize for racing through this part of the paper. But I'll just indicate three moments of continuity. There are certainly others, I think, that come into view with the resolute reading. The first is given with the two quotations I've paired from the Tractatus, the Investigations, and item 4 in the handout. Now, there's differences in style and emphasis here. Differences which, as you'll see, soon, I think, matter. Nevertheless, resolute readers are going to think that there's a continuity of philosophical aspiration between the two books that these remarks help to highlight. In the first remark, Wittgenstein gives voice to an aspiration that the second remark shows to continue to be central to his later philosophy, namely the aspiration to practice philosophy in such a way that it does not issue in a doctrine or a theory, but rather constitutes or consists in the practice of an activity he characterizes as one of alloitor, elucidation, or clarification, an activity which he says does not result in philosophische Sätze, say in propositions of philosophy, but rather in just klar werden von Sätzen, a phrase that he and Ogden argue quite a bit about how to translate. But let me gloss it this way. In our attaining clarity in our relation to the sentences of our language that we call upon to express our thoughts under the pressure of philosophizing. And the second of these remarks in the investigations emphasizes a feature of this aspiration that I think is already present in the early work in a form, namely, to put forward remarks that no one could disagree with. One can, of course, try to take the remarks thus put forward as theses, to build on them as if one could disagree with them. But that effort, in the end, will not be able to sustain the weight we put in the remarks. They will not be able to bear the weight of a thesis, for one of a variety of reasons. But some of that variety is already present in the Tractatus. Some things will merely turn out to be tautology. Other things will turn out not to say something in the way that we take them to. Now, standard readers are going to agree if you just show them these two quotations. Sure, there's an appearance of a continuity here. But they'll be inclined to think that resolute readers are prone to overestimate the significance of this appearance. They're going to think that when early Wittgenstein says his aim is not to put forward a doctrine, what he really means is, well, not an effable doctrine, not something that can be meaningfully formulated. For Wittgenstein does, on standard readings of the book, it seems to me, aim to put forward a number of rather substantive metaphysical doctrines, ones that can be identified with things on the first list. It's just that the doctrines can't be expressed. They have to be conveyed by other means. Now, appreciating this difference I just mentioned in the respective understandings of the Tractatus you get in the part of standard and resolute readers, I think is crucial for appreciating their differences and, shall we say, their misunderstandings about how to weigh or bring external evidence to bear on the question of how early and later Wittgenstein relate to one another. Standard readers take there to be doctrines the Tractatus fully aims to espouse, even if he can't express them. And it's just these doctrines that they then look in later Wittgenstein's writings for his criticisms of, when they're looking for his criticisms of his earlier self. It's not open to resolute readers to understand the relationship between early and later Wittgenstein in those terms, since for many standard readers, those are the only terms they can envision for arranging a conflict between early and later Wittgenstein. That gives rise to the presumption that, as David Stern has told you, resolute readers have, in their zeal to be resolute, altogether deprived themselves of any resources that could furnish a coherent account of discontinuity between early and later Wittgenstein. Gotta do this faster, Jim. Okay, two more quick continuities. Now we're at items 5 and 6 on your handout. This is a continuity that we might put this way, that there's an important moment of continuity in Wittgenstein's understanding of the task of philosophical clarification, where the moment in question has to do with the role of a transition that latent to patent nonsense plays in the execution of the task early and late. So each of these passages tells the reader there's something he must eventually recognize to be nonsense in order to understand what the author of the work is doing in putting these things forward. Third moment of continuity, item 6 in the handout. When a sentence is called sentence, it's not senseless. It's not, as it were, its sense that is senseless. We cannot give a sign the wrong sense, is the way this thought appears in the Tractatus. Many standard readings of the later work, I actually think, turn on an understanding of the character of what later Wittgenstein calls grammar that seems to me to involve the very misunderstanding of the logic of our language that early Wittgenstein was already essentially concerned to criticize. That is, they take what Wittgenstein's doing when they're criticizing the philosopher to show that he's violated grammar, these rules of grammar, and you cannot say that because grammar forbids you from doing it. By the lights of a resolute reader, you here have Wittgenstein going backwards. Something that early Wittgenstein already understood very clearly and was central to his thought is being lost if you read later Wittgenstein that way. One of the advantages of getting the Tractatus straight is that certain readings of the later thought are not going to appear attractive. So that's part of the point of getting these continuities into view. So, in short, I confess a certain degree of guilt to the charge of mono-Wittgensteinism. There are continuities that will interest you if you read the Tractatus, or I've recommended in my published writings. Next, I was going to say some things about the preface, the investigations, and what Wittgenstein's interest was in having the Tractatus and the investigations published together. And I was going to make something of the fact that he says, you can understand his later, his new ideas, those in the investigations, only by contrast with and against the background of the Tractatus, and suggest that that only hasn't really been appreciated. It doesn't make sense if one finds the mistakes the Tractatus, where people usually do. It would look like they're much less confusing kinds of background that you could go for as well. I had quite a bit to say about that, which I'm going to skip in the interest of time. Let me just summarize where I would be at this point if I had read everything to you this way. Standard readers, we saw, take there to be substantial doctrines that the Tractatus fully aims to espouse. The first list gave us examples of those. And it's just these doctrines that they take later Wittgenstein, his criticisms of early self, to be essentially concerned to criticize. We also saw that resolute readers take there to be no doctrines of this sort, that is, ones that the Tractatus wittingly aims to espouse. And that means that any substantive philosophical commitments of the Tractatus that later Wittgenstein is going to be concerned to criticize, resolute readers are obliged to regard as ones that early Wittgenstein did not himself aim to espouse qua substantive theoretical commitments at the time of writing the Tractatus. But that doesn't mean, as David Stern suggests, that a resolute reader is committed to the idea that Wittgenstein's own self-understanding of what he's doing in the Tractatus is unmistakable, and therefore there can be no discontinuity. A resolute reader need only be committed to the view that if we want to understand what the author of the Tractatus thought he was up to at the time he wrote the book, we do need to be clear about what the terms of that original self-understanding were, and that means taking these moments of continuity seriously. But claiming that is perfectly consistent with maintaining that by his later lights, that original self-understanding is deeply diluted in important respects. So resolute readers are perfectly free to ascribe to Wittgenstein, early Wittgenstein, misconceptions. The difference is that they will be obliged to take those misconceptions to be lodged in his early understanding of the activity of philosophical clarification. An understanding of that activity, which, at the time he wrote the Tractatus, he took to be free of substantive commitments that would be open to that sort of criticism. They will take later Wittgenstein to regard early Wittgenstein as having embraced a conception of philosophical clarification, which reflected his being in the grip of a picture of language without his having realized it. And so his whole mode of criticism's early work that comes up in his later work is not going to come into view for you unless you understand that in his early work he's committed to a project of clarification which is meant to be anti-doctrinal. And then the point is to see how free that conception of the activity still was in the early part. More executive editorial decisions taking place before you. Okay, some things about unwitting, I was looking for that forever. I'm unwitting commitments. List two on your handout. So this is the list that is, figures as item eight on your handout. Again, same structure. I give you some examples. But list two figures as a kind of list that could be extended indefinitely. Something belongs on list two if it's an unwitting commitment in the sense that I indicated above. That is, something that later Wittgenstein is going to view as a substantive metaphysical commitment that came with his earlier understanding of how philosophical clarification proceeds. These are commitments that underlie the conception advanced in the Tractatus of what it is we need to do in order to make philosophical problems disappear. In the interest of time, I won't read through this list, but I will point out the following, because it's important to the kind of issue I want to get into with you now, which is that items on some expression or expressions in each item in this list is italicized. Without that italicization, you already have a somewhat more delicate issue about exactly what the commitment is. The italicization is meant to indicate the occurrence of what we might call a moment of metaphysical insistence, or what qualifies as such a moment by Wittgenstein's later life. A moment in which a requirement is being laid down. The metaphysical commitments at issue here, as I said, are not ones at the time of writing Moorhand out. The time of writing the Tractatus, early Wittgenstein would have seen as involving a substantial step. I think there's a sense in which he wouldn't have seen many of his theoretical commitments at all, let alone peculiarly his. You can use notation, in a way Martin Gustafson nicely gave us an example of, to make certain problems disappear. You've done it. See, this is what it showed. He doesn't see the use of the notation itself as being deeply structured by certain understandings. He thinks of it as simply emerging from something we can do and achieving clarity. So he would have regarded these things that figure on this list as pertaining to matters that become clear through the process of clarifying propositions, through the adoption and application of a perspicuous notation, a notation that enables one to avoid confusions. Now, there is an idea here, you won't find a sentence that says this, but there is an idea here of there being a way to furnish an absolutely clear expression of our thoughts. That already is part of the metaphysics of the Tractatus. But he didn't see it that way. In his early work, his aim in writing the book was to bring metaphysics to an end. And the method of clarification he sought to practice to achieve that end was itself to be free of all such commitments. The next item on your handout, this is the second item eight on your handout. There's a quotation that Oskar Kuzel has also drawn attention to in his writings. Here's a way of reformulating what I take it that remark from Settle is trying to say about his early work, borrowing from certain other language from the investigations. The crucial moment, or moments, in the philosophical conjuring trick performed by the author of the Tractatus are the very ones that appear to him most innocent. They are ones that are performed by him on himself without his realizing it. They take place at a stage prior to any in which he imagines himself to be engaged in the activity of propounding substantive doctrines. It's very important, I think, to the way the Tractatus is written, that it's trying to identify that very subtle moment of transition. We've gone from saying something banal to having begun to insist on something, to have laid down a requirement. And one's not going to fully appreciate the bearing on his early work that later Wittgenstein takes the method of investigation, the method of the investigations to have, I think, if you fail to appreciate the extent to which these sorts of things, things that figure in my second list, things that I think are central metaphysical doctrines of the Tractatus, what in my other title you might have called the hidden metaphysics of the Tractatus, how those things are the sorts of things that are able to appear to its author at the time of writing not to be doctrines at all, able to appear utterly innocuous, innocent of such commitment. If we fail to appreciate this about the early work and look instead for explicit doctrines of the sort that we find in other books in the way that we find them, then we're completely going to misconstrue the kind of criticism of the early work that the later work seeks to prosecute. Okay, skipping even more practically. Now, I was going to talk about in the paper I now talk about Moses. That is, I talk about the quotation that figures as item 9 in your handout. And what I try to do is use that as an example of the tremendously complex relation you actually have between early and later Wittgenstein's thoughts. There are many things there you will notice as actually involving continuity of thought with the Tractatus. There are views he's criticizing there. He criticizes the Tractatus. At the same time, the way he's criticizing them involve criticisms of the Tractatus. And I was going to try to show you some of that weaving by going through the other quotations in the handout. Time doesn't permit that. Then I thought of calling it Martin in Metaphysics to bring out the way Martin's example here, I think, would furnish us another case. What I claim in the paper is a very strong claim, but I think I'm willing to stand by it, though it takes quite a bit of testing before we'll ever know whether I should, is that you can pick almost any moment in the investigations, and you will find this complexity of relation, that is both continuity and discontinuity in the relation of the Tractatus. So there's a sense in which if you focus on passages of the sort that figure in these lists of external evidence as the crucial place to understand the linchpin between Wittgenstein's early and later thought, even there you're, as it were, minimizing in another way the depth of the criticism. It's something that looks like you're heightening it. What it's going to bring out, Martin uses this TF notation to bring out Wittgenstein's criticism of the idea that the logical constants represent, for example, negation represents. And he mentioned a continuity between this and Wittgenstein's treatment of sensation, and the way in which he tries to bring out when sensation terms are not referring. And he tries to bring out perspicuously bring out features of the way we talk about them, to bring out how they don't work in an ordinary referential way. I think there's a genuine continuity here, just the sort Martin was trying to indicate. I also think that's a very good place in the investigations, that is, that very same place, to look for the criticism of the Tractatus. Because part of what's built into the Tractatus' method of elucidation here is a picture of what the inventory of possible kinds of uses of language there are. Their names, they function by standing for things. And they're things that don't. Like, for instance, the logical constants. And then the problem is, if you ask the question about sensation language, which is it? Does it refer or doesn't it refer? Part of the point of the investigation's treatment of that is you're lost either way you try to answer that question. Negation does not stand for a something. The Tractatus is right about that. But sensation language, as he puts it, is not a something and not a nothing either. That thought, the resources of the Tractatus and the ways of, as it were, investigating the kinds of multiplicity in language there are, blinds you from. So there's a criticism at the very moment there's a continuity. I'm using Martin's example to give you a very quick case of that. Moses is a much more subtle and more complicated case. But I think that is pervasively true of the relationship between the early and the later thought, which brings out what I think is misguided about standard ways of trying to align early and later Wittgenstein. Give a list of doctrines, find the passage in the investigations where the criticism proceeds. I think that misses what he was asking us to do in the preface when he wanted these books bound together. And it was only these two books that are bound together that could get you to read the investigations in the way you wanted. Just quickly, I'll point to the third list, and then I'll stop. The items on the third list are meant to bring out the true complexity of the task of really trying to think about the relationship between the Tractatus and the investigation. Again, this list is meant to point to a kind of list that could be extended indefinitely. The sentences on this list are going to represent things that the author of the Tractatus wants to say. I tried to more or less paraphrase sentences of the Tractatus. But they're going to be things of such authority that if you ask the following question, does the author in the investigations agree with or disagree with what the author of the Tractatus wants to say here? You're going to have a problem. If you try to say yes, it's not going to be quite right. And if you try to say no, it's not going to be quite right. That the only accurate thing here to say at this hopelessly unhelpful level of generality is something like, later Wittgenstein agrees with early Wittgenstein about each of these items. And later Wittgenstein disagrees with Wittgenstein about each of these items. For there are significant aspects of the conception of the Tractatus that substantially, though again unwittingly, color his earlier understanding of each of the matters pertaining to philosophical clarification that are at issue here. Just to take the first five items on the list, there's a sense in which early and later Wittgenstein want to say each of those things on the third list. But there's a conception of what order and perfection, what vagueness and definiteness, what logic and language come to, that's going to make a difference to what you're doing and trying to hold fast to what it is that each of those sentences say. And there's aspects of the conception of the Tractatus that color his conception of what vagueness, definiteness, and so forth must come to, such that that's what we're saying when we say this. What marks a sentence out as belonging on my third list, therefore, is that it can alternately be construed as saying something that early and something that later Wittgenstein each would want to say, in the sense that they're perfectly happy with those forms of words, but they would each mean something importantly different in displaying those forms of words in the context of the larger work. So I've given you three lists. The three lists we've looked at bring out a bit of what I'm trying to illustrate about the complexity of the relationship between early and later Wittgenstein. All three lists involve sentences that figure in, or are implied by, or appear to be implied by sentences of the Tractatus. Now, there are commentators who wish to emphasize the discontinuity of Wittgenstein's development. And I think what you find in such commentators, and in their criticisms of my work and Kordaima's work, is that when identifying what they take to be the early doctrines that are criticized in the later work, they move indiscriminately between items of the first two lists. Items in the second list get on their list because they know somehow later Wittgenstein wants to criticize those, so they must be important to the Tractatus. But they're mixed in mostly with items of the first list, which is what they find when they're looking in a hurry for the metaphysics of the Tractatus. And that very indiscriminateness is going to lead to, I think, a crucial failure to understand the relationship between early and later Wittgenstein I was trying to highlight. Then there are commentators who wish to emphasize continuities in Wittgenstein's development. That's really all they want to do. I don't think that's at all a good description of what I want to do. But I think what you find in such commentators is that they tend to sharply distinguish items drawn from the third list, things that early Wittgenstein says, that later Wittgenstein also says and says. And they say, here, see the continuity between early and later Wittgenstein. Thereby failing not only to distinguish items that belong in the second list from those that belong in the first, but failing also to appreciate the extent to which later Wittgenstein, in his criticism of items in the second list, is at the same time prosecuting a criticism of his earlier self's understanding of each of the items on the third list. You can't get either the continuities or the discontinuities in view by trying to encapsulate them in the form of a proposition. So, in conclusion, I think an appeal of a resolute reading is it allows the Tractatus to come into focus in a manner that brings these different kinds of commitments in the early work into helpful relief. It allows one to make good sense of why Wittgenstein is concerned to focus on just the sorts of things from the Tractatus he does single out for criticism in the passages in his later work, where he's actually occupied with the task of criticizing Tractatus. Something that puzzled me a great deal when I first started reading Investigations. I read a book in the Tractatus and I go, why isn't he mentioning this stuff when he criticizes the Tractatus? And that's also why he's not drawn to mention the Tractatus when singling out for criticism his later work all kinds of things that figure on the first list. That is, the sorts of views that resolute readings do not ascribe to the early work. So it's not only part, or at least it can be, not only can be part of a resolute reading, that it doesn't want to mount an apologia for a resolutely mono-Wittgensteinian creed, but actually, on the contrary, it can be a central motivation of being interested in such a way of reading the Tractatus, and as I've been trying to say, it is a central motivation of my wanting to read the Tractatus this way, that one's trying to improve upon existing accounts of the discontinuities in Wittgenstein's philosophy by furnishing a reading of the early work that affords a more promising background for a textually satisfying and philosophically nuanced account of where the real discontinuities lie. Thank you.